You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Beth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow here at Brookings and co-director of the Brookings LSE Project on Internal Displacement. We're delighted to welcome you to this session on Turkey and Syrian refugees, the limits of hospitality. This is really to launch a report that my colleague Kamal Karici has just completed called Syrian Refugees and Turkey's Challenges Beyond the Limits of Hospitality. And Kamal will be presenting his report and the amazing feat of doing this in only 12 minutes or so. And then we'll have comments from three esteemed colleagues from different sectors of those working on the issue of Syrian refugees and displacement. Before we begin, however, it's important to put this into a broader context. What's happening in Turkey is certainly of concern to all of us with respect to Syrian displacement, but it's really just a part of a much larger phenomenon. Displacement in Syria right now is massive, it's rapid, it's dynamic, it's changing. Inside Syria, and largely invisible, are at least 6.5 million internally displaced persons living within the borders of their country. As with IDPs, internally displaced persons everywhere, they are the responsibility of the national government. And we know, we've heard most recently in the UN Security Council about the difficulties in accessing people in need inside Syria. Obstacles that include bureaucratic hassles of visas and vehicles and countless signatures required on forms to deliver aid within the country, as well as ongoing fighting, disputes between warring rebel groups. The internally displaced in Syria are very large percentage of the displaced people in and from Syria, often quite invisible. In the neighboring countries, I think the latest figures are that close to 3 million people have sought protection in all of Syria's neighbors. The rates going into Lebanon, which now has over 1 million refugees, are 50,000 people every month arriving in Lebanon. Smaller but still significant numbers arriving in Jordan. Lesser numbers in Egypt. You know, when you look at the number, the extent, the scale, the dynamism of displacement, it's hard to get a sense of how this will all end. Even if for some reason, miraculously, the war were to end tomorrow, it would be a long time before most of those displaced were able to find solutions, whether going back or being able to set up new lives in neighboring countries. So even though we talk a lot in terms of numbers of those displaced, the sheer scale of human tragedy of what's happened in Syria and the consequences on those who've been forced to abandon their communities is certainly a cause for concern for us all. Kamal Karici, you all have the bios in the packets that were given to you. But Kamal, my colleague, is the 2CAID senior fellow here and at Brookings, and the director of the Turkey Project of the Center for the United States and Europe. He's written extensively, many books on Turkey, has lectured at universities around the world, and certainly it's been a pleasure working with Kamal. At Brookings, we've been following issues of Syrian displacement for about the past year with some degree of intensity, I would say. And it's been a joint initiative between my work or our work on displacement and humanitarian issues with Kamal, whose expertise is politics and asylum and immigration policy and Turkish politics generally. And the third component has been our colleague at the Brookings Doha Center in Qatar, who's been looking particularly at the role of Gulf actors vis-a-vis the Syrian humanitarian situation. So following Kamal's presentation of his report, we'll turn to three commentators. We'll begin with Daryl Griesgraber from Refugees International, who's worked on these issues for a long time. You were in Cairo for a while and comes from a human rights background with Amnesty International. We'll then turn to Burcu Erdoğan, who's a career diplomat at the Turkish Ministry of Foreign Affairs here at the embassy, serving as political counselor. She's had various postings, but is particularly steeped in the Turkish political reality. And then we'll turn to Joe Livingston, who's a foreign service officer working on Turkey with the Bureau on Population, Refugees, and Migration, who just spent the last 3 months in Turkey looking especially at issues around Syrian refugees inside Turkey. So we're delighted to have all of you, and we'll begin with you, Kamal, and you've got 12 and a half minutes, 15 okay. minutes, so go all ahead, right. to present Thank your you. Report.
Thank you. Well, thanks for being with us this afternoon. I'd like to start by thanking Beth, because when I came to Brookings in 2013, January, I thought I was, to use a soccer expression, hanging up my boots as far as refugee issues, asylum went. And just a few months into my presence here, Beth came up to me and said, you know, you've done all this work previously, why don't we put a project together? And it's been a very enriching experience for me. We have had a chance to go together to the Syrian border with Turkey, visit a number of refugee camps, as well as talk to a wide range of people, government officials, intergovernmental organization representatives, civil society representatives, etc. But on the other hand, Beth, I have to make a confession that it's a sad story. It's a sad story when you get exposed to the human dimension of it. And I think what is striking about this particular refugee crisis that we've been looking at is the children, that the children are in great numbers and obviously to some extent oblivious to what actually is going on and oblivious to the future. And this is where I'd like to start. This report is not about the causes of people fleeing into Turkey. It just accepts, very sadly, that a solution is not around the corner, and that a little bit like previous refugee crises in the region, from the Afghans to the Palestinians, I fear this one is going to be a lasting one as well, most probably not very different than the previous cases. And dare I squeeze in here that I've been working on this topic since I got started on a PhD thesis in London that was looking at the Palestinian refugee issue back in the early 1980s. And as the French expression goes, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. Things stay really, unfortunately, the way they are. So what I've done in this report is look actually at the consequences and the implications of this particular reality and the challenges that Turkey is facing. Now, I'd like to start also by saying that this is not the first experience that Turkey is having with mass influxes of refugees. I have lived with a series of them from the beginning of my career at Boğaziçi University. 1988 saw 60,000 what they call Peshmergas, because at the time Turkey could not use the word Kurds towards them. And that was followed by a massive influx of mostly Kurds from northern Iraq in 1991, March and April, close to 500,000, and another million fleeing to Iran. In between came 310,000 of Bulgarian Turks and Pomaks to Turkey. And I won't go into the details of those experiences, but only flag out that this one is considerably different than the experiences that Turkey had with these earlier mass influxes. Firstly, numbers. Although the one in 1991 involved close to 500,000, this one is now close to 1 million, and government officials together with UNHCR are expecting that this may well approach 1.5 million by the end of the year. The second important difference, and this is, if there is a pleasant story to this one, is the response that the government has given. Back in 1989, the Bulgarian refugees were received with open arms. Legislation was, special legislation was introduced very quickly, precipitously, to allow these refugees to bring in their, if you might recall them, their Trabants, their Moscoviches, and whatever they could save from Bulgaria without taxes, without much paperwork. They, in many ways, were extended rights above what Turkish citizens could experience. And housing facilities were provided, credits were provided for them. Much more importantly, citizenship was extended very quickly. And they were very lucky, very lucky. Unlike the Middle East, in this case, with a regime change in Bulgaria, within a few years, Bulgaria setting out towards membership to the European Union, they went back and acquired Bulgarian citizenship. So they had the best of both worlds. However, the Kurds in both mass influxes were treated very differently and were referred to as guests. The Turkish state at the time shied from using the term refugee, thinking that the use of the term refugee would automatically engage them in obligations under international law. And though the world and some of us too tried very hard to say it doesn't matter what term you use, the reality speaks for itself. And subsequently, in 1994, the first internal legislation was adopted in the form of a regulation, which very clearly states that in the face of mass influxes of refugees, refugees must be stopped on the other side of the border unless there is a government cabinet decision to the contrary. And this is what happened in 2011, as Syrian refugees began to trickle in. By October 2011, the interior minister of the time, in front of the IOM and UNHCR in Geneva, announced what they called the open door policy with temporary protection. These were music to the ears of human rights people and people like myself who had been involved in these in this issue for some time. So the Turkish government really has to be commended for adopting that. The unfortunate part of it is that the temporary protection details were only elaborated in a secret regulation that that human rights people that have had access to it say very much abides with international law, and they fail to understand why it is kept secretly. The third difference, beside the response one, is that it comes, meaning these decisions come at a time when the number of individual asylum seekers to Turkey are also increasing. When you look at the UNHCR trends report, in 2010, Turkey was the 15th country with respect to individual asylum applications in Turkey. In 2013, Turkey had moved up to the fifth place. So it is, this mass influx is coinciding with a time when individual asylum applications are also increasing. And lastly, it is happening at a time when, after many years of consultations and effort, Turkey has adopted a brand new, from scratch, law that addresses asylum issues beside immigration issues. And the law also created the first brand new bureaucracy in Turkey since the one that was set up in 2001 when Turkey's EU relations had been launched. And the agency that the law sets up came into force last month and now is responsible to take over the Syrian refugee crisis as well. I think I will, for the benefit of time, I will also spare you the details of the figures. They were distributed there. There are about 220,000 who are still in refugee camps. Camps continue to be referred to as five-star camps, and there too I think the government deserves credit for the kind of services and facilities they are providing. But the number who are outside camps is increasing, and this is where the difficulties lie. And it is with these difficulties that we come to the challenges. I have a string of challenges that I have laid down in the report, and I go into considerable detail. However, here I have just about 6 minutes or so, if I can see the clock there correctly from here. So I will just pick up two or three challenges. One challenge that I consider as being the most significant and relates to all the other challenges is that Turkey has to brace for the long run. In other words, the refugees are here to stay. Initially, the Turkish government at the initial stages was very generous and magnanimous in many ways, even told the international community that they did not need any help and chose to be excluded from the first Syrian regional response plan in 2012. I think the expectation there, if I dare to say this publicly, was to kill two birds with one stone. Extend this generous treatment to the refugees with the expectation that within months they would be going back and that there would be a very grateful community in Syria and would help to build strong bonds between Turkey and this new Syria. This has not happened. And during the interviews we had, especially the ones I had in January with MPs, MPs from governing party as well as opposition party, it became clear that they too are very conscious. And they pronounce years like 10 to 15 years. So these are significant years. So extending citizenship is an extremely controversial issue, would be extremely controversial. And during the run-up to the local elections, there were even growing speculations that the government was going to enable them to vote in the local elections, expecting that by and large they would vote in favor. However, this was never really the case. And the government has also provided statistics that between 2011 and the end of 2013, only 70 Syrian nationals were extended citizenship. So the idea of a blanket extension of citizenship is extremely unlikely because the law that governs these issues, a fundamental law of Turkey dating from 1934, allows citizenship and settlement only for people who are known as coming from Turkish descent and culture. And this is the context in which the Bulgarian refugees received their citizenship. However, integration is already taking place. Many of the those who are outside camps, one way or the other, with their means, sometimes with assistance from NGOs, sometimes from the municipalities, are trying to adjust, look for employment, arrange for education of their kids. So the second challenge I'd like to refer to is education. The figures for the number of children in Turkey, Syrian refugee children, is very confusing to me. Both UNHCR and UNICEF puts it around 52-53%. But anyone who goes to the camps and walks the streets of the towns along the border can immediately see that there's a huge imbalance between the number of grown-ups and the number of children. I feel that these figures somehow need to be revisited. 60%, 65% of the refugees' children in camps have access to school. But it looks like the schooling diminishes as the age of the children begin to increase. The problem is much vaster outside the camps, and there too there are different figures. Optimistic figures put 25-26% having access to schools. Most of these schools are run by either by refugees themselves or Turkish and NGOs, and the curriculum that is followed is the curriculum from Syria, except that it has been cleansed from any coverage of Assad, where he is being aggrandized or whatever the appropriate term there is. However, this creates a challenge in Turkey, because we may go into this in questions and answers. Right now, Turkey is trying to address the issue of the Kurdish problem in Turkey. And one of the hot issues is this very fine but politically important difference between teaching a language like Kurdish and teaching a curriculum in Kurdish. So if you allow Syrian refugee children to be taught in Arabic their curriculum, this would become very difficult to reconcile with the government's reluctance to allow for a curriculum in Kurdish as opposed to just the teaching of Kurdish, which is permitted. Mm-hmm. From here, I'd like to move to one last challenge. Keeping my eye, I realize I'm going a little bit over time there, is what I called administrative challenges. That is the challenges that this new agency is facing and ought to be addressing, and I'm aware that there is an effort in that direction. The first challenge there is to develop a public, transparent regulation governing temporary protection. Lots of details have to be developed there, and it has to be public as far as refugees goes, but also human rights organizations, etc., go. Hand in hand with this is the issue of voluntary returns. Though the government argues that they work very closely with UNHCR, and again, give them credit, this is a very important detail, because Turkey in the past had made a nasty reputation for violating what is known as the non-refoulement principle. There's been hardly any refoulements, forcibly returning refugees to Syria. But there needs to be a regulation that governs this and allows for monitoring by human rights organizations. Last challenge, administrative challenge, is the issue of registration. That Turkey has still not completely registered refugees outside camps. And what is somewhat disconcerting but understandable given the nature of the crisis and the way in which the crisis has developed is that there's been a number of different efforts at registration, duplications, and waste of resources, and this will need to be addressed. Lastly, it's international cooperation. I will be very brief on that. In a refugee crisis, at the end of the day, is an international responsibility. Turkish government regularly repeats that they have spent $2.5 billion on the refugees, with another $500 million coming on top of it from NGOs, compared to $3.6 billion by the European Union for the whole region and $1.7 billion from the United States. Joe can correct me if I'm wrong there. The Turkish government says we need help, and and they are in the most recent Syrian regional response plan. But the problem there is that the return to appeals, the fulfillment of UN appeals for resources in the case of Turkey has been much lower than the neighboring countries. And imagine how this can easily be abused for domestic political reasons, but also in terms of public opinion. Last important aspect of international solidarity is resettlement. There's a very old tradition of the international community resettling individual refugees from Turkey to the US, to Canada, and elsewhere. That tradition needs to be revitalized in the context of this particular crisis, and I suspect Joe will probably go into that as well as Burcu, and I better stop there and apologize, Beth. I hope she won't fire me from this project. I'd like to continue.
No, thank you very much, Kamal. Before we open it up for questions, let's hear from the three of you. We'll begin with Daryl from Refugees International.
Yeah, thanks, Beth, and thanks to Brookings generally for calling us together here and for the report, Kamal. I think it's very timely and brings some important attention to issues we haven't been looking at quite as much lately. I'm with Refugees International, and I cover the Middle East. And in practice, what that meant for 2 years is all Syria all the time. So we've spent a couple of years going back and forth to all the host countries in the region, as well as occasionally inside of Syria when we can get there. And Well, one of the things that we have found is that there is a similar pattern to all of the Syrian refugee situations in the host countries. And Turkey in some ways fits that pattern, in some ways does not. It's quite unique in a couple of aspects. One of the things that I most appreciated about the report, Kamal, is that you talk a lot about the urban Syrian refugees in Turkey. That is the Syrians who are outside of camps. It took a while for Turkey to catch up with recognizing that there was this huge population outside of the camps, and they're making a good concerted effort to start offering services and protection and to register people. But it was a bit slow in coming. It was one of the later responses. Lebanon and Jordan, for example, and even Egypt to some degree, were recognizing out-of-camp refugees a bit sooner than they did in Turkey. So as I said, in some ways, Turkey's quite representative of what's happening in the region for Syrians. The numbers of people arriving began in a manageable enough way. Everyone thought it would be short term. The influx started to create a strain on the host communities. There was competition for resources. And, you know, we're talking about healthcare and food and shelter and education. In places like Jordan and Lebanon, you're talking about competition for water, in fact. So sometimes it is that basic in some places. And as the tensions rose and resources became more scarce, host communities became a bit less welcoming. You've probably heard what's gone on in Egypt in the past few months, in particular with the backlash against the Syrians. And last time we were in Turkey as Refugees International, we also noted that people were becoming much less friendly to the idea that they had so many Syrians arriving in the country. And so the aid from the international community was also quite slow to arrive. 3 years in, you know, all these appeals from the United Nations are still being funded quite slowly, and it's creating hardships in responding to refugees. One of the results of this has been there's been more careful border management because host countries feel like they can't keep taking in so many people. And so this is a pattern that has played out in all five of the major hosting countries. It started a little bit more slowly in Turkey because initially what we heard, right, was Turkey has set up all these fantastic camps for all of the refugees. They're doing the response by themselves. This is all going really well. And there wasn't a lot of attention paid until we started to discover that there were all these refugees outside of camps who were not being served all that well. Turkey is unique in the sense that when all of these Syrians started arriving, Turkey itself was a worldwide provider of humanitarian aid, in fact. So it had some ability to provide for refugees, as well as the responses it was carrying out around the world. And initially, because of a lot of its resources, it chose to handle the Syrian refugee response mostly on its own. I think in 2012, there was a small donation, an in-kind donation of tents or something like that. But for the most part, Turkish government's been handling it solo. And the camps were acknowledged to be largely quite good. And so it was easy to sort of stop paying attention to that. And then we heard nothing about the urban refugees. So this is where this all starts now, about the problems that they're having, which are exactly like the problems they're having in Jordan and Lebanon and Iraq and Egypt. One thing that is also interesting about Turkey, and I'll be interested to hear what you have to say about this, Kamal, is that in a couple of the southeast border provinces, we were told by local governments that, in fact, employment for Syrian refugees in Turkey was welcome and quite helpful, even though it was unofficial. So it's an interesting aspect of this because we have not heard that in any other countries, and it prompts you to wonder what could be done in a useful sense with having so many refugees who need work. So RI's own experience in Turkey, actually, I've been thinking recently, is quite comparable in some ways to what we saw in Egypt, but that's where I'm most recently back from. And I say that in the sense that the government of Egypt, like the government of Turkey, has been putting certain restrictions on the agencies that could offer humanitarian aid. And this is part of what is impeding good response to the refugees, as well as some local governments that are maybe more or less welcoming to the refugees and willing to help them out. There are significant restrictions on operations for humanitarian NGOs, and even getting a registration is often difficult. And there are a number of both national and international organizations that have been trying and who have planned for work with the Syrians, and in many cases even have the funding to do it, but can't get the permission to operate. And while this is happening, again, to some degree in many of the hosting countries, in Turkey and Egypt, it's been particularly pronounced. And one of the things that we always talk about to the government is getting local civil society more involved in the response. So the timing is great on the report because it's really acknowledging that we've got this gigantic urban population. And I think a really big deal to have come right out and said they're probably going to be here for a long time, and we all need to be prepared for that, host communities, governments, and the world in general. Turkey is capable. Turkey is generous with its response. Turkey also needs to balance its security concerns about refugees with its humanitarian obligations. And again, this is something that we see happening in all the hosting countries, but it's an important thing to point out. Burden sharing by the international community, by donors, and that includes both financial donations and resettlement. Again, I think the report acknowledged well that resettlement is not going to be sort of the largest solution for the greatest number of people. Annually, I think about 1% of all the refugees in the world get resettled, maybe a bit less. So yeah, so if you break that down into numbers, not a whole lot of Syrians are going to be going anywhere. So support for the refugee response and humanitarian response is really more important than it's ever been as the numbers get bigger and bigger. Turkey has the chance, I think, to do something quite interesting here that we heard the International Organization for Migration say recently, and that's that migrants should be incorporated into development plans, and they should be considered a benefit to a country's development. And in light of the fact that in some places, Syrians have been quite welcome to work in Turkey, for example, they're looking more at education and what they can do to integrate Syrian children. And with Turkey's interest in being welcoming and responsive to the Syrians, there's potentially a good chance here to really be an example for the world of how migrants can be involved in development and really beneficial to a country. So I think I'll leave it at that because I'm guessing you guys both have much more to say, but happy to take questions afterwards.
Thank you very much, Daryl. We'll turn now to Burcu from the Turkish Embassy.
Thank you, Daryl, also for giving some of your time to me since I have a couple of issues to mention. First of all, I'd like to thank Brookings Institution for the organization of this very timely event, and in particular to Professor Kilici, who draws attention to the challenges facing host communities by citing the Turkish example. And I believe that the challenges faced in other host countries are almost the same. And particularly, I'd like to say that at a time when the crisis in Ukraine often hijacks the discussions on Syria, I hope that this today's discussions will give a heads up for decision makers and the public opinion as well. Professor Kish's report, I read it in full with deep interest. It was very comprehensive, detailed, well explaining the challenges Turkey currently faces, and it was thought-provoking and raised many questions that need to be answered. And I think that it makes a very valuable contribution to discussions which will continue to occupy us in the days and months ahead, hopefully not years, but unfortunately I'm not that optimistic. Just a few comments, and I will leave other issues for the Q&A session. I would like to start by asking this question of whose reality. Professor Kishi addressed a very timely question, how to deal with the refugee crisis in the long run, in the long term. And answered that reality dictates us to focus more on issues of integration rather than emergency humanitarian assistance. And I think Daryl also added her voice to that comment. Yet for the host countries that disproportionately shoulder the burden of the refugee influx and have become the main target of the spillover effects of the crisis in Syria, the perceived reality is different. From the standpoint of the five neighboring countries hosting almost 3 million Syrian refugees and whose resources stretched to a breaking point, the question is inevitably focused more on how to ease this burden on them in the short and near term, and as such, how to put into effect international mechanisms to help them overcome the difficulties they face, we face now. The fighting goes unabated in Syria. There is no political solution in the horizon. The regime is continuing its indiscriminate attacks against civilians. Its Star Wars surrender strategy still keeps blocking international humanitarian aid access to and within Syria. And we are talking about projections that soon, at the end of this year, the number of refugees in the region will reach the 4.1 million. So all these factors are drawing a very gloomy, a very dim picture for the neighboring countries and also in particular for Turkey. Because this means should the current situation remains unchanged, pace of flow of refugees to neighboring countries will hardly decrease, resulting in enormous pressure on already strained resources and capabilities. Thus, the reality dictates us to deal with the immediate repercussions of a crisis, which is not of our own making. And I'd like to underline here is that the crisis in Syria is no longer just a Syrian problem. Not a regional problem either. It's an international problem requiring international response, and it's the responsibility of the international community to protect Syrian refugees. So the neighboring countries and Turkey are doing all these efforts on behalf of the international community as a whole. And Syria has become, as Director Ferris has mentioned, as the largest crisis of forcible displacement in the world. And a whole country is losing its population. And this has very serious effects to the regional peace and stability. Yet so far, countries in the region, in a sense, absorbed the impact of refugee crisis, thus containing the repercussions of the crisis in Syria within the region. However, we believe that this is neither fair nor sustainable, even in the short term, and that's the reality facing the host countries. When we look at the Turkish example, numbers speak for themselves. I don't want to repeat what Professor Kirishci and what Daryl has already mentioned in terms of the number of Syrian refugees in Turkey, but I just would like to draw your attention to one fact that when the first population movement from Syria to Turkey take place in April 2011, the number of Syrians in Turkey in the camps were 252. And today we are talking about 800,000 Syrians, mostly living in urban settings, urban locations, the so-called urban locations, refugees. And it makes Turkey the second biggest host of Syrian refugees after Lebanon. And as was mentioned by previous speakers, at the beginning it was fairly manageable for Turkey because we were experienced in terms of mass refugee influx, and also we were also one of the major humanitarian assistance donors, so we had the capabilities and we had the experience. Yet despite all these, as Professor Kirish just mentioned, the Syrian crisis, unlike any other crisis, unlike any other mass refugee influxes Turkey had in the past, posed very serious and very important challenges before Turkey, which was very difficult to manage just by ourselves. We'll not go too much into the detail what Turkey did and still does in order to cater the needs of the Syrian refugees. I can give more information at the Q&A session if need arises. Since I'm in Turkey's efforts, particularly for those inside camps, have often been praised at the international level and also at this meeting. Yet, as was mentioned by previous speakers, a momentous challenge for us now is those living in cities, urban locations. This appears to be a much more critical phase, since 60% of Syrian citizens seeking temporary protection in Turkey are now spreads across the country, not just in border provinces. And it is not as easy to identify and reach to those people as the ones residing in camps. So far, we managed to register 500,000 of them in cooperation with the UNHCR, yet the work is not complete because the refugee flow is continuing day by day. Just to maybe outline a few things without going into the detail, about the things that we're doing to face this enormous challenge. First of all, an interagency mechanism has been established. A plethora of state authorities are active in all 81 provinces of Turkey. They're working in close cooperation with UN agencies, with local and international NGOs to cope with the demands of the Syrian population. And the employment issue has been mentioned. A recent study has been conducted. There are discussions on facilitated employment system. And also there is a plan to put more Syrian children into schools. These are all in the pipeline, but of course it takes time to devise these plans. And the new institution and the new law on foreigners and international protection, which came into force very recently, was mentioned by Professor Kirishi. This is very important. I just would like to underline that because for more than 60 years, there was another law, the old law was enforced. And that law had brought very much constraints and limitations on refugee issues. So the way the thinking in Turkey changed, I think this change in law, the new law, represents this important issue. So how the pressure on host countries might be eased? In your report, Professor Kirishi, you identify three options, and you also referred to two of them in your presentation. Voluntary return, resettlement, and integration into the host country as the last but inevitable option in the absence of a political solution. Well, I do agree with the difficulty in terms of the first option under the current conditions. However, we must not give up efforts in creating the conditions for the voluntary return of refugees to their homes. I know that we're not discussing the causes of the Syrian refugee crisis here, but it's one of the important elements that we shall not ignore or rule out. With regard to the second option on resettlement, and certainly much more could be done. So far, 17 countries have agreed to participate in UNHCR Syria Resettlement Humanitarian Admission Program. The program aims 30,000 refugees to resettle by the end of 2014. This represents only 1.5% of refugees and only 0.4% of the total number of Syrian IDPs. I think the problem is that many countries are more concerned in keeping Syrians out rather than letting in. And the open border policy seems like an applicable criteria only for the neighboring countries, which shall not be the case. So I think the call that Professor Kirishi make in his report has been a very timely one for the international community to shoulder the responsibility and share the burden. What neighboring countries want, what Turkey expects from the international community. What we expect is an active engagement and meaningful contribution in sharing the burden. We are grateful for the cooperation. We are grateful for the support given to us by friendly nations, by the UN, several NGOs. However, the overall assistance and response of the international community unfortunately remain limited in scope. When we look at the UN Regional Response Plan that is devised to ease the burden on the neighboring countries, unfortunately it fell short of adequately meeting the demands on the ground. I will not give figures because Professor Kirishi already mentioned those figures. And in terms of the financial toll of the crisis on Turkey, Professor Kirishi mentioned $2.5 billion and according to the latest projections, it has almost reached $3 billion, and it's continuing. So I believe that this cannot be considered as a fair share of burden. Lastly, on integration issue, undoubtedly this is the most controversial issue, the most difficult one. Without full international solidarity, fair burden sharing, effective regional as well as international mechanisms, which are missing currently, integration option would be deemed by host countries as a means to make the burden on them permanent, and thus relieving the rest of the world of their responsibilities to protect refugees. At a time when we still try to deal with the emergency assistance issues, and we believe that it's not a medicine that will ease the host country's problems. And while the refugee flow is continuing incessantly, it's not a viable option either, because when we speak about integrating more than 3 million refugees, which will soon surpass 4 million, I think it's a huge number, and it's too much to ask from the neighboring countries only. So I took a note here to my colleague Joseph from the State Department. Please correct me if I'm wrong. My memory might betray me, but the refugee admission ceiling that was authorized by the U.S. administration for 2013 was 70,000. So just only in Turkey's case, we are talking about 800,000 Syrians. So there should be maybe a balance in terms of the expectations from the host countries. So what is the durable solution? Well, in addition to resettlement and international financial and development aid, the most important thing is the political solution to end the human suffering. But since there is no political settlement in the horizon, then what should be done is to find a solution to the problems, to the needs of the refugees inside Syria, within Syria. So the international community, from the perspective of the neighboring countries, is that should take resolute action for an increased humanitarian assistance to all Syrians through cross-border and cross-line operations, and should strive to meet the needs of Syrian IDPs inside Syria. There has been a UN Security Council resolution which was adopted last February. Unfortunately, it fell short of expectations in terms of the implementation. We're still awaiting some positive results, which is not the case. Yet that is very important issue for us. I mean, the UN has been dysfunctional for almost 3 years, and this is what we didn't expect while extending our hospitality. So I just wanted to give the perception of the neighboring countries and in Turkey with regard to these issues. We'll be happy to share my comments on other issues in the Q&A session. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Burcu. And now we'll turn to Joe Livingston from the State Department's Bureau of Refugees, Population, Refugees, and Migration.
First of all, I want to thank you, Beth, and thank Brookings for hosting this. This is a really wonderful and important and timely opportunity to exchange ideas on this subject. And Kamal, I've read your report. I think it offers a tremendous amount to think about in terms of the social, economic, political impacts of hosting such a large refugee population for a protracted period of time. So I think what I'm going to do is kind of go through your major challenge areas, although I'm going to do it in slightly backwards order. I'm going to talk first about the urban context, then talk about international burden sharing, and then kind of go through the line quickly on the rest, and hopefully we'll still have plenty of time for questions. So I think Kamal's paper and my colleagues have emphasized very clearly that this is really, really very much an urban context that we're working in. Estimates by the Turkish government are 900,000 or more refugees. Some believe that the number already is quite more. There are gaps in the registration system, so it's impossible to know exactly what those numbers are. But what we do know is that the situation is dynamic, and if we compare where we are now to where we were a year ago, things have changed really quite completely. Whereas 1 year ago, almost all of the Syrians were in camps, now we find that 75% or so are in urban areas. And in those last 3 months that I spent in Turkey, I got to get some flavor for what that context looks like and what the needs are. And it's those human stories that you're really left with. And I think it's also that human... is that me?
No, you're right. Big brother is keeping an ear on us.
From that experience in being in Turkey, I'd like to identify a few of the needs in urban areas that really need attention. One of them is shelter. I had opportunities in Istanbul, in Kilis, in Gaziantep, in Şanlıurfa, in a whole host of cities to go talk to Syrians, talk to refugees in their homes, and learn about their experiences. And the situation from city to city to city, universally, Syrians are finding themselves without adequate housing, often three, four families in a single home, often living in shelters that are not adequate. And this is something that will continually need to be addressed. In places like Kilis, where the population by many estimates has doubled as a result of the refugee influx, it's often very difficult to find an apartment at all, causing many Syrians who arrive to that border to seek shelter elsewhere. It's causing rent to skyrocket in places across the southeast, and Kamal notes that in his report. Beyond shelter, education is really a pressing need throughout the whole country. Our partners, including UNICEF, believe, even at a conservative estimate, probably more than 70% of the Syrian population that's camps, urban combined, are out of school. When you account for the fact that the rates are quite a bit higher in camps for enrollment, it gives you a picture of just how difficult that context is in the urban setting. There are about 100 or so estimated community schools. These are schools run by Syrian local organizations, run by various nonprofits, and they help, but their curriculums are often unregulated. The standards are not always uniform between them. But more than anything, they're only meeting a very small fraction of the demand for quality education across the country. Other needs, information gaps. This is something that we noticed in almost every city. I spent some time, for example, at the Gaziantep bus station and just talked to Syrians who were gathering there trying to figure out what they were going to do next. Some of them had just arrived from Aleppo the day before and were trying to decide whether they'd go to Istanbul or to Kilis or some other town. And uniformly, the issue that these Syrians had was they had no idea where to turn for help. They routinely said that they didn't know where to go to register, or they didn't know how to register, or they didn't know where to go for health care, or to get basic services at all. And this is very true across the whole country, including places like Istanbul, where I came across a family on the side of the road in the suburbs, the far suburbs, with a sign saying in Turkish, essentially, you know, we need help, we don't know where to turn, and they really didn't, and the language barriers don't make this any easier. Some governments, particularly regional governments, for example, in Shanlorfa, have made great efforts and strides to try to educate Syrians about what to do. They've created a poster campaign and pamphlets in Arabic and Turkish, inform people where they can go for basic help, health care, etc. And this is something that we hope will increase moving forward. The other thing on that the urban side to keep note of is that this is only going to continue to grow. If we do reach 1.5 million, that percentage in the urban areas is going to just be a higher proportion. Camps are not likely a major part of the answer moving forward. If you look at the numbers from last July or August, there is an increase in the camp population, but it's 20, 30,000. And that number is trickling upwards. There's very few spaces left in a few camps that have been opened in the last 4 or 5 months, and the plans to open up new camps from everything I've heard are very limited. So I should also say at this point that for the individuals who have been in the camps, Turkey's efforts have been nothing short of monumental. The quality and consistent care that Turkey has provided Syrian guests in those camps is really quite spectacular. And I had a chance to visit several of these camps. Many of my colleagues have visited the rest. And almost uniformly, the conditions are above and beyond international health standards and what should be provided in terms of health access and education in many cases and provision of foods and non-food items. So Turkey's efforts are known by the community, and they should be supported and acknowledged because they are really quite significant. And even in the urban area, Turkey has opened up its hospitals and medical system to Syrians, and a lot of that $3 billion plus that Turkey has provided, as we understand it, comes from footing the medical bills for so many Syrians, including in urban areas. And the international community is very grateful. And as well, Syrians who I had a chance to meet in many conversations acknowledge that, you know, while they often were lacking basic support to find housing or their children weren't in school, they were grateful for the protection that Turkey has offered and for the fact that Turkey has kept open borders to allow Syrians to enter. In terms of the international burden sharing, which is a topic that I think Kamal, you touch on quite heavily in your paper and we've discussed here. I'd like to make a few points. First, Turkey's assistance, as mentioned, is tremendous, but we also want to be a big part of the answer in responding to the needs of Syrians, and we stand with Turkey in their resolve to find solutions both inside Turkey as well as solutions inside Syria. And I think it was mentioned that the U.S. has provided $1.7 billion of assistance, and we believe that assistance, much of which has gone to help vulnerable families, vulnerable individuals inside Syria, as well as in host communities inside Lebanon and Jordan, that assistance goes a long way. We're also providing $127 million in support to Syrians in Turkey. It is less than what's provided in Jordan, Lebanon, reflecting that Turkey has had the ability and means to do a whole host more. But we believe that that support does go a long way. And I'll just break down a little bit of what that does. In the camp setting, that's provided helped to provide several hundred thousand tents, blankets, cook stoves, schools, health clinics. We're doing a tremendous deal through our support and our major partners, including UNHCR and UNICEF. And in urban areas where we are heavily focusing now, our partners, again, UNHCR and UNICEF being largely among them, but also UN Population Fund, World Health Organization, they're providing support in urban areas. And through international registered NGOs, increasingly we're finding ways to provide support. And that includes opening up community centers, which we've done in several communities, to provide information, psychosocial counseling, opportunities for children to play and to find some solace and relief. And we've helped through our partners to provide direct support in host communities throughout Southeast Turkey. That support includes funding to allow families to purchase food, to pay for housing, as well as support for medical needs, including clinics, and as well youth programs. And we're hoping to do more. We have an outstanding request for proposals out, and we're constantly looking at ways that we can work with our international partners and our NGO partners to boost the response. And in that context, we look to Turkey and the government of Turkey to help us in helping you to meet the needs that we acknowledge together are growing and will continue to grow inside host communities throughout the country. So just to outline a few other points that Kamal made. Kamal, you talked about bracing for the long term, and we couldn't agree more that that is how we have to contextualize the problem. Almost every Syrian I spoke to, invariably, there were a few exceptions, but almost all said, you know, their priority is just returning home and having a normal life, being able to support their families, and just have what any family would want. So at this point, I do believe that Syrians, by and large, are really posited on the idea of returning home. But even in the best-case scenario, as I think we've pointed out, that timescale is going to be protracted. Even if the war ended today, it could take 3 to 5 years, given the enormous development challenge, rebuilding schools, rebuilding homes. This is, in the best-case scenario, a long-term situation. And whether we talk about integration in the context of, you know, citizenship, as you mentioned, or we talk about it in smaller steps of expanding working rights in certain sectors, which is a discussion that's ongoing. The reality is Syrians are there, and as time goes on, the stresses on host communities are increasing, and we'll need to look for solutions, practical solutions, that help to facilitate cooperation between Syrians and their hosts. That can include language training. It can include opportunities for more Syrians to enter the workforce in a legal fashion. Currently, Syrians throughout the country are working, but many of them are working in factories and in agriculture and are doing so far below the prevailing rates for Turks. So if there are ways that we can facilitate greater participation in the labor market, in a way that's good for Turkish communities and good for Syrians, I think that will have a very positive outcome. Kamal, you talk about education, and I think after the immediate need, perhaps, of housing, education was the thing that parents over and over and over again talked about as the thing they wanted most. Parents are very well aware and very keenly interested and emotionally involved in the importance of education in terms of the future of their families. And whether that means a future in Turkey, a future resettled to Europe or the United States, or a future inside, back in Syria, education is a critical component. After several years of being out of school, it becomes harder and harder to integrate students back into a formal setting. So solutions that allow us to facilitate more both formal and non-formal education will be critical. One of the things we're doing to help is we're providing a significant amount of funding to UNICEF. UNICEF is supporting Turkish government's efforts through AFAD, the Emergency Directorate, and the Ministry of Education to build new urban schools across the country. This will not solve the problem on its own, but it does go a long way to finding solutions for some of the most vulnerable families. And then finally, you talk about administrative challenges to which the General Directorate for Migration Management, GDMM, is really at the center of that. And I should say that the General Directorate for Migration Management is a new agency with an enormous, daunting task ahead of them. That task is to coordinate assistance, to coordinate all the different entities and agencies that are providing assistance. But more than anything, it's registration. And registration, comprehensive, needs-based registration that takes into account vulnerability criteria, is absolutely critical to identifying who needs assistance where and ensuring that that assistance can be delivered. With 1 million or so Syrians, it's not going to be possible to deliver assistance in a blanket fashion. So improving the registration system, which I believe GDMM is quite focused on doing right now and is quite interested in doing with much support from UNHCR, I think that'll be the way forward for truly finding and helping those in need. It's a daunting task at a time when they're a new agency, when they're staffing right now, when they're still building capacity. But the U.S. government position is to support GDMM in any way possible, to help them have the tools and resources they need to mount the response that's necessary. And just circling back for one more second in terms of international burden sharing, I want to make a point about resettlement. I said earlier on that the majority of Syrians I spoke to really are focused on returning home. And that's our priority goal, is having Syrians return to a peaceful state in Syria to eventually be able to have a normal life in Syria. But resettlement as well will be one of the solutions. And we, as the lead resettlement country, the lead resettlement agency resettling 70,000, as you mentioned, in the last year, we are committed to resettling Syrians. UNHCR has committed to referring 10,000 Syrians this year from Turkey, 30,000 regionally, and those numbers are going to increase in the years to follow. We respond to those referrals from UNHCR. We historically have responded by resettling the bulk of those referrals, and we will continue to look at ways that resettlement can be one of the durable solutions for some of the most vulnerable families. Obviously, it's not going to be the solution for the majority, and in the meantime, we will continue to provide humanitarian assistance in the neighboring countries and work with our strong partners like Turkey in facilitating other ways to reach Syrians, both in Syria and in Turkey.
Okay, thank you very much, Joe, and thanks to all of you for your comments. Let's open up now for some questions. We have microphones that are coming, and if you could identify yourself. And I think we'll take three or four questions and then ask you for a response. We'll have Bill and then one. One, two, three, four. Yep.
Hi, Kamal. I thought your title was particularly provocative. I wanted to ask you about beyond the limits of hospitality.
Could you introduce yourself?
What you mean by beyond the limits of hospitality? Because you mentioned guests as the terminology that had been used before, because hospitality refers to guests, and guests can be reach the limit of the hospitality and then be told to go home. In this case, are we looking at a situation where the government is recognizing a binding legal principle of non-refoulement, or is this still a political decision as magnanimous and as generous as it has been? Is this something that could change even overnight, depending on a change in government or a change in political decision? Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, please. If you could identify yourself, please.
Hi, Ezgi Canpolat from World Bank. I really like the idea that Turkey can do something very unique and can turn this into a kind of a development, look at the issue from a development paradigm. And Darli, you also touch upon on that potentiality. But I'm also wondering what are the challenges, for instance, with respect to the integration of the Syrian labor force to Turkish economy. I came across some accounts mentioning the exploitation of the Syrian workforce. So what do you think, like how we should address these issues and while we are moving forward to see this as a development challenge? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have the woman in the green and then...
Hi, Sarah
Stand
Hudgens.
Up, it's a little bit easier.
Sarah Van Hudgens with Georgetown University. A similar question about integrating Syrians within Turkey. In terms of them being part of the labor market, I've read Turkish complaints of them taking services and money from the government as well as harming the labor market and driving up prices. I'm curious from Burcu if the Turkish government considers this a problem, and if so, if there's any attempt to have a public campaign to change Turkish sentiment.
Thank you. Yes.
Tolga Tanisvetyuriyet. One of my questions actually was regarding this labor market issue, because you said that it can be part of the development, but when you compare this situation in Turkey right now with, for example, Mexican issue in U.S., how can Syrian refugees can be part of the development in Turkey in the long run? Because we have still here 11 million illegal Mexican workers, for example, and it's part of the unemployment problem, as far as I know, how it can be a part of the development. And the second question is about the education, as Professor Krishci mentioned. What is the long-run policy of Turkish government on this issue when it comes to the integration of the children to education system? When they stay, for example, 5 or 10 years in Turkey, it's obvious that it's beyond the humanitarian crisis. To keep them away from the crime is one of the major issues for Turkish government. What will be the legal base of this topic in Turkey when you compare, for example, with the Kurdish issue? What is the legal framework of this education vision of Turkey for this Syrian refugees?
Thank you. Would you like to have a chance to respond? Maybe you want to start with the title question, Beyond the Limits of Hospitality.
Yeah. Bill Frelick, we go back a long time as part of Human Rights Watch, and then before that, the committee on, I forgot the name of it. very different world, mid-90s. I frankly, when I said beyond the limits of hospitality, I had in mind our previous report that focused on the limits of hospitality. And the title meant to capture that now it's not just about hospitality, it's about going beyond it and facing the actual realities as we brace ourselves for the long term. Now, whether the principles that have been adopted in the context of temporary protection, which includes non-refoulement, will remain as permanent elements of Turkish foreign policy, Turkish policy, asylum policy, I'd like to think that this is the case. But, you know, Turkey these days is full of surprises. We thought that Turkey had become one great member of the pluralist democratic community, and we seem to be slipping away from it. But in spite of all the bad news, let's say, that may be coming out of Turkey, the good news is in this area. And Joe has made references to the new agency, and that new agency is really headed by a unique person. But then he's not that unique, because he comes out of the Turkish state apparatus, and he is deeply committed to human rights issues and rule of law issues. So I'm hoping that these new principles and new policy that has been adopted by the government will be a means to protecting Turkey's or re-implanting Turkey's democratic credentials. And it has a link to this developmental issue. There I really agree so much with Daryl. But how does one change a certain set of mind that is ingrained in what I would call state habits? In one way, the temporary protection policy is a surprising, extremely welcome development. But at the same time, when I look at the reflexes of the Turkish state in this particular context, I also see old habits. And one old habit is, Burcu, don't misunderstand me, is to kick the ball back to the international community. Whereas I think what we share in common with Daryl is this idea that the international community, and to take up Joe's line, let us help you, whatever the line was there. That Turkey has to, it's beginning to do it, Daryl, in all fairness. In international non-governmental organizations were having great difficulties in getting themselves registered in Turkey. It is still not perfect, but from the conversations I have had with Turkish officials, I think with some confidence I can say that at least a good part of the state apparatus recognizes that there's something rational in you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, that they need these organizations to address the problems and the challenges in Turkey, and that they need to make it easier for them. But they are also recognizing that by making it easier for them, they will also address some of the security issues that have been referred to. So with a bit of an effort with respect to this frame of mind, I realize I may be sounding terribly naive and unrealistic, but I do see an opportunity there to come up with a new exercise, an exercise that could set a model there. What else did I... Mexican workers, and there's an interesting parallel there. But, you know, I could argue that the U.S. is trying to address it, and maybe Turkey, what it could do is to learn from that experience and respond to it in due course. And Daryl is again flagged out a very interesting point. In Gaziantep, there is full employment right now, close to full employment. According to the Turkish Statistical Institute data, there are only three provinces in Turkey where unemployment has fallen in the year 2013. One is Gaziantep, the other is Kilis. So there's a very curious situation where there's complaint about Syrian refugees stealing jobs and pushing wages down, but at the same time, Syrian refugees are also providing a boost into the local economy. And this is something that maybe deserves close attention and close research. And I could see the link to development there. And maybe I should stop here.
Mirju, do you want to respond to any of the questions about labor market
yes,
or integration?
Thank you. First of all, I'd like to start by the first question about whether Turkey will continue its open-door policy and non-refoulement principle would be binding or not in the future. But I think there is no room for surprise because, I mean, the past 3 years record of Turkey is self-explanatory in that regard. Despite that massive refugee influx, despite day-by-day increasing number of Syrians seeking refuge in Turkey, and despite the major security concerns, for example, the extremism radicalist threat next to our borders, Turkey kept its doors open for all Syrians without any discrimination, regardless of their ethnicity or regardless of their religious affiliation. So I think our record is pretty much straight on that. And the Turkish government officials made clear several times that we are determined to pursue non-refoulement principle. And so far, we strictly observe that principle. So in that regard, I believe that there is no room for a bad surprise in the future. I'd like to respond to the criticism made by Professor Kirishi about old habits that Turkey still has. Well, I think this is a pretty unfair criticism, since so many things have changed. As Professor Kirishi himself also mentioned, a new law on foreigners and international protection recently came into force in Turkey. This was a very important development. As I also said before, for more than 60 years, there was another law which was much more restrictive one in place. So with this new law, the situation of Syrian refugees will also be addressed. And as a matter of fact, one of the main reasons why this new law has been adopted was the presence of Syrian refugees in Turkey. So, and in that regard, Turkey has been doing its homework. I mean, we're not just asking from the international community to do everything on our behalf. Yet, as I said before, this is an international problem requiring international response, and this is the responsibility of the international community as a whole. So not just Turkey, not just Jordan or Lebanon has to handle this whole burden by themselves, but on the other hand, we are doing the best we can. I will just make a few comments on the employment issue in relation to that, for example. The standards in the camps are unmatched and were often praised, but we also recognize and increasingly acknowledge the presence of urban refugees. And the government is holding brainstorming sessions on these issues, how to meet this challenge, how to put the relevant mechanisms on the ground in order to, prevent further aggravation of the problems on the ground. And for example, for the employment, as I also made reference in my speech, that there is a work currently conducted by the Ministry of Labor to find answer to this question, to facilitate employment opportunities for the Syrians residing in the cities. And currently, on the basis of the new law, those Syrians who hold residential permits can allow for employment opportunities without being asked for conditionalities, without being asked for additional papers or some of the things that were asked for required in the law. So there is already work going on this issue. And on the education as well, there are some efforts to put more Syrian children in schools. In addition to those private schools and those schools that are administered by the Syrians, the Syrian children can also be enrolled in public schools as well as guest students. But, we acknowledged the daunting task, and we know that there is a lot more to do. But as I said, neither Turkey nor any other country can do this by itself alone. So this is why we make a call to the international community, why we ask for a fair share of burden. I will not touch upon the Mexicans issue. I will leave that subject to Joseph. So there was another question that was raised by the lady. It was about the integration of Syrians and how the sentiment, if I don't understand you wrong, how the sentiment in Turkish public opinion might be changed. I think the way to change the Turkish public opinion is to make this fair sharing of burden known by Turks, because currently the understanding in the overall population is that Turkey is doing everything by itself, that the Turkish government has spent more than $3 billion to meet the needs of the Syrian refugees, whereas if the international NGOs, United Nations Organization and European Union and other Western partners would do more to help Turkey in its efforts, then the public sentiment in Turkey would also change positively. Thank you.
Thanks. We just have a few more minutes. Are there a few quick questions? Yes, please.
My name is David Becker. First, thank you for this presentation. It's been really informative. I recently returned from serving as a U.S. Peace Corps volunteer in Jordan. And during that time, I was researching the refugee issues over there as well. And one of the things that I heard from my neighbors and from reading reports from some of your colleagues at places like Mercy Corps and IRC were finding that a lot of refugees in Jordan didn't want to register. Partly because out of fear that they might be put on lists back in Syria or other issues. Have you found any ways to alleviate that kind of problem where they don't want to be registered?
Registration, Joe?
Sure. So in some ways, first of all, I'll say that is a problem in Turkey as well. It's a problem in the south to some extent, although more and more word-of-mouth campaigns and the prevalence of mobile registration trucks that AFAD is using and GDMM is increasingly a part of, and we've helped to fund these trucks, that has increased the prevalence of Syrians who are coming forward to register. There are still fears by some Syrians. They're not well-founded, but they are fears that registration and somehow entering into a database controlled by a government might make them more vulnerable, more susceptible. And outside of the Southeast, the registration efforts are still very nascent, often not so coordinated and not feeding into the same system, a bit more ad hoc. So registration in places like Istanbul and Izmir and Ankara is far less prevalent, not always owing to fear of registration, just because of the nature of the system. But the key to all of this is information, giving Syrians information about what registration entails, who has access to the information, and also incentivizing the process of registration. So if a Syrian isn't clear on why they ought to register, whether that's receiving health benefits or enrolling a child in school or at some point participating in the labor force, they're going to be less likely to do so. Mm-hmm. And as we enter another iteration of the registration process with this new general directorate building a new database, and they will be attempting to re-register Syrians to get more data leading to vulnerability criteria and to enhance protection. When those efforts happen, it'll be even more incumbent to ensure that it's coupled with an information campaign for Syrians nationwide that says, this is why you ought to register, and these are the tangible benefits connected to it.
Thank you very much. Our time has come to an end. Is there final comments you'd like to make, Daryl?
Yeah, I'd like to. Yeah.
Yep. Yes, of course, Kamal.
It's just 1.5 minutes out there. When I compare what's happening today in the context of Syrian refugees in Turkey with 1991, March and April, the two experiences are mountains apart. At the time, I remember the Turkish president, Turgut Özal, in front of CNN with a stick in his hand and a map of the region, trying to convince, and he did successfully, that the refugees should be moved from the border area in Turkey as quickly as possible into northern Iraq. Few people know that the infamous Resolution 688 was actually drafted in Ankara at Burcu's ministry. The instinct there was to push them out. And then events evolved in a very different way. Now we have a Kurdish regional government, and you could even argue that maybe it was partly conceived by Turkey inadvertently. But on this occasion, when you look at it very closely, independently of some of the things I've said about mindset, etc., I do see much greater cooperation that is taking place. It's taking place at the governmental level, maybe at the very early stages for the reasons I cited. Turkey wanted to take care of this on its own, but at the end of the day, I do see the will to cooperate with that international community. Maybe the will the strength of the will differs from one agency to another within Turkey. But I also see civil society. We didn't talk about it. Today, compared to 1991, there's a very lively Turkish civil society. And where I see if there is a problem is the international civil society having maybe some difficulties in relating and adjusting to this vibrant Turkish civil society that, incidentally, Joe ought to be encouraged to also apply to funds that are being made available from the European Union and the U.S. government elsewhere. So the mindset I refer to also applies to the international community, that maybe the international community has to adjust to some extent, that this is a very different Turkey that we were accustomed to work with 15, 20 years ago. One last observation I'd like to do is to invite you to have a look at the report. It is already on the web. It has many more details that I think hints at possibilities of working together, Turkey and the international community. Just to give you, I'd like to give you two concrete areas where I wish I could see much more in-depth cooperation. One, there's been a lot of talk about education, but it's the issue of certification of diplomas. Very critical for the parents that worry about the education of their children. But it's also very important in terms of the future, whatever happens to Syrian refugees. The other very fascinating issue is, again, certification, is, for example, the registration of new births, especially outside camps. A very critical issue that I believe is not yet being addressed. And in many ways, the Turkish authorities, I think, are somewhat at a loss as how to address this issue, and there must be experience out in the international community that could come forward towards addressing this particular issue there.
Well, thank you, Kamal, for those comments and also for your report, which is available online now, and I know that you all look forward to reading it. Join me, please, in thanking our panelists.